The next case for argument is 22-1210, Michael Johnson, Logging v. Secretary of Agriculture. Is it Mr. Hochhalter?
Hochhalter.
Hochhalter. We're ready whenever you are.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Kevin Hochhalter, and I represent Michael Johnson Logging. Today we ask the Court to reverse the Contract Board's denial of Johnson's claim for breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing. Because that duty is based on the reasonable expectations under the contract, the first step is to examine and interpret the contract. A correct interpretation of the contract shows that Johnson's expectations of straight skid trails was reasonable and thus formed a basis for that duty. The department's admitted adjustment of the skid trails to gain more reserve trees was a bait and switch which appropriated extra value to the government at Johnson's expense. So let's look at the contract.
But before we even get to the contract, the board kind of had two alternative conclusions. And one was based on, irrespective of what the contract says, you didn't provide evidence with respect to the breach and finding, in terms of findings with regard to the skid trails. So how do you get past that hurdle, notwithstanding the contract breach issues?
So, Your Honor, it does come back to the contract interpretation because the board viewed the contract as explicitly allowing the department to consider the reserve trees first and to move the skid trails in order to save more of those reserve trees. So if that's what the contract explicitly allows, then the expectations under that contract are very different. The expectation then would be the purchaser looks at it and says, oh gosh, I might not get my straight skid trails. They might have, you know, reserve trees all over the place. And so what the board was looking for was, okay, we know. In fact, the board acknowledged, this is at Appendix 9 in the board's findings, that the department did adjust the skid trails to save these reserve trees. So that did happen. That was proved. It was admitted by the department and found as fact by the board. But what the board was looking for was something more, to say, if the expectation is that there's going to be some of these, then you can't breach the duty of good faith and fair dealing unless it's excessive.
I thought that what are you referring to on page A9? Because my recollection was that there were only slight changes made, or the characterization of the government was that only slight changes were made to the planned or requested skid paths. So what is it on page A9 that you're referring to for these significant, the evidence that would support that there were significant changes made?
Well, so to be clear, it is that saying that there were slight changes made. That's admitting that there were changes made. That's what I'm saying.
But where is there any evidence that there was any complaint about that or concern about that from the get-go?
There is evidence of that. That's a slightly separate issue, but, you know, it goes to the department's sort of waiver argument saying, well, you never complained. Johnson testified that he complained. I think the most telling evidence here is if we look at Appendix 1771 to 72, that's Johnson's testimony, where he talks about the complaints that he made early on to Chris Anderson, and then later with Jana Carlson, the administrator, talking to her about the skid trails and saying, it's impossible for me to work like this. And according to his testimony, she said to him, well, the skid trails have to be laid out this way in order to protect the resource. Now, that's not a quote. That's a paraphrase. But then we compare that to Ms. Carlson's testimony at Appendix 1855, where she acknowledges having this conversation with Mr. Johnson. In her testimony, she says, you know, in short answers to direct questions, no, I wasn't aware that he objected. But then she says this, quote, what I recall, the discussions I recall having with him were focused on, this is what the contract says, these are the provisions, this is why what you proposed is not being approved by the Forest Service. So she's acknowledging she had that conversation with him about the skid trails and about the changes that she's been making, which she believes are according to the contract, because she suffers from the same misinterpretation that the board adopted. That is to say, the reserve trees get considered first, and you move the skid trails to avoid them. But that's not what the contract says. The contract says, and this is, we look at a combination of provisions, but the central one is C2.35, which is the designation by description. Okay, it's got all the different descriptions that tell us which trees can be cut and which trees can't. But it says in that provision, quote, all skid trails slash roads and landing clearing limits shall be identified and approved before this provision, this designation by description provision, is implemented. So right there it says, you do your skid trails first, and then you figure out what the reserve trees are.
It says, let me ask you something else. I understand your position on that. What do you make of if you look further up on this same, in the same page that you're looking at, which is A739, it says, all western red cedar will be cut except within the designated clearing limits, or with approval. And none of the other provisions that are limitations indicate that there's any exception for within the clearing limits. And I understand that you're reading clearing limits to be the skid trails and the landings. So what do I think of that? I mean, I read that. How do I read that? Does that mean usually if there's a provision that applies to just one type of tree here, we'll say trees, it says western cedars, those can be cut within the clearing limits. But there's no provision like that for all of the other limitations found in Section C2.35. So shouldn't I read that as meaning that, in fact, those provisions apply even within the clearing limits?
I apologize. I don't have that page in front of me. Could I ask you to read one more time the specific provision that you're talking about?
Yeah, so I'm reading all of C2.35, and it has all those things that can't be cut. And it identifies trees by diameter and different things. But right. There's one provision that talks, there are several provisions that talk about particular types of trees. And there's only one of them that talks about an exception for areas with clearing limits. It says, no western red cedar will be cut except within the designated clearing limits or with approval of the Forest Service personnel. And so, you know, Okay. Under a typical rule of contract interpretation, if there's an exception for just one designation, that means that inherently that exception doesn't apply to the other areas where you can't cut. Does that make sense?
I think so. So if I'm understanding it correctly, what you're proposing is because it says red cedars, it's carving out that exception.
That red cedars.
That specification for red cedars, then other trees are going to be treated differently.
That's right.
And
that means those exceptions apply even within the clearing limits.
Yeah. That's where I think, I think we have to look at reading the contract as a whole, right? We have these other provisions that talk about the clearing areas. For example, specifically B2.32, where it says, all timber is designated for cutting that is within the clearing limits. And so how do we reconcile those two, right?
Doesn't the section of the provisions in C override the provisions in B? I mean, B is it the general contract, and C then is the specific implementation for this contract? Do I understand that?
Right, but the fact that it says red cedars will not be cut within the contract area, it doesn't say that Douglas fir or I'm sorry, I misspoke, but you know, the fact that it says something about red cedars within the clearing areas, it doesn't say specifically that some other tree will not be cut within the within those areas. So there's not really a conflict. There's not an overriding.
Did you say B2.32 is what you're reading?
Yes.
Yeah, but that says all timber is designated for. Okay.
So everything within those clearing limits should be cut. Everything. That says everything. And then the specific thing says, oh yeah, red cedars should not be cut there. It doesn't say, for example, Douglas fir can remain standing there. So it's there's not an overriding provision in C. There's only maybe an implied conflict, but that's we can't let an implied conflict override the express terms in B. And if we look at the contract as a whole and what it's supposed to be accomplishing, what is the bargain here? The purchaser needs to be able to move the equipment in and out of the forest in an efficient manner in order to make this an economically beneficial proposition. And so what the department, the bargain that the department made through this contract was, okay, purchaser, you get up to 20% of the total area for your landings and skid trails that will be completely cut down, but we, in the other 80%, will keep our reserve trees. That's the bargain. And by misinterpreting the contract and designating the reserve trees first, the government betrayed that expectation.
So when the government made adjustments to your proposed skid trails, those adjusted skid trails, did those still have trees in them?
That's something that I was not clear on from the record. From Mr. Johnson's perspective, he had skid trails that had trees in them. From the department's perspective, they had skid trails that were moved so that the trees were not in the skid trails. But the end result was the same. Mr. Johnson had to do these back and forth turns while, although they're slight, they say, you know, his equipment has treads. When you have to turn.
I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, did Johnson have the unilateral right to define what and where the skid trails would be and what they would look like? Or did they need to be approved by the agency?
They needed
and
to
in
be.
In that way, the agency would have the power to make adjustments to those skid trails.
Right. They needed to be approved, so the department had some discretion. But what the contract did not allow the department to do was to look at the reserve trees first and then change all the skid trails to reserve all of these trees at Johnson's expense. At the very least, looking at it in terms of a duty of good faith and fair dealing, although they may have had the discretion, the power under the contract to make some adjustments, in doing so, they betrayed the expectations of the bargain. And so we ask the court to reverse, and I'll reserve what remains of my time.
Thank you. Mr. Bird, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. This court should affirm the board's decision below because Mr. Johnson, the proprietor of Michael Johnson Logging,
is there anything in the record that clarifies whether the skid trails, as approved and adjusted by the government, still contain some trees?
Your Honor, there is unequivocal testimony from the contracting officer as an initial matter. At Appendix 1853, Ms. Carlson says, quote, there were no trees left in the skid trails or landings that were approved by the Forest Service. The appellant recognizes in their reply brief, at least, that this was established as testimony from the contracting officer in the record, and that is why there has been somewhat of a moving of the goalpost in this case. The opening brief discusses there being skid trails replete or full of trees. The approved skid trails were full of trees that therefore caused allegedly inefficiency. In the reply brief, there's an allegation, well, now we recognize that, oh, well, maybe it's unclear whether there were trees in those approved skid trails. Therefore, now we're talking about trees on the edges of the skid trails, making them undulate or weave in a certain way. Zigzag, as we laid out in our brief, is a overcharacterization of what happened, particularly in light of the appellant's proprietor's testimony that he, having run the job...
Does the government agree, though, that if there were trees in the skid trails as approved by the government, that that would be a real problem, that that would, in fact, you know, to require Johnson Logging to operate on skid trails that had trees right in the middle of them would be a breach of the contract?
Your Honor, no, we do not agree that this contract required the agency to approve skid trails.
But you could imagine a lot of different problems there would be in trying to perform the contract if there were a bunch of trees right there in the skid trails.
Your Honor, yes, one can intuit that there may be inefficiency caused by having to run around different trees within those skid trails.
Well, what, like, you know, what if the tree was right smack dab in the middle of a 12-foot wide skid trail? What is one to do under those circumstances?
In those circumstances, Your Honor, the purchaser here, Mr. Johnson, could have complained to the agency if that was the issue at the time. As the board found, based on substantial evidence in the record, there were no contemporaneous complaints in the almost 300 inspection reports that the parties executed throughout this job. And additionally, there was on those inspection reports routinely approval of the varying proposed skid trails from the purchaser. For example, the board cites, in its opinion, I think 10 of those reports. We have one here at Appendix 1027 that talks about the approval of skid trails. On each of those inspection reports, Mr. Johnson could have deleted, if inapplicable, the phrase, "I agree on behalf of purchaser." There, therefore, is a record of contemporaneous agreement to what was done. Additionally, there's a record of a contemporaneous good relationship between the parties performing the contract. There are no substantiated allegations of contract interference in this matter. If Mr. Johnson ran into an unworkable situation, there's testimony in the record from the contracting officer that her MO would have been to engage with Mr. Johnson and fix the situation as best they could. There is extensive evidence in this record of a cooperative relationship regarding the planning, construction, and approval of both skid trails and landings.
Do you have a couple examples you could highlight of where Mr. Johnson faced an unworkable situation, reached out to the contracting officer, and the contracting officer made adjustments in light of those complaints about an unworkable situation? I don't think there's an example where Johnson came forward and said, "There is a tree right in the middle of the skid trail. I cannot work here with a tree right in the middle of the skid trail." But are there other examples?
I did annotate the board's opinion. I can pull it here. The board's opinion at pages appendix 9 through 10 cites approximately 10 inspection reports, and I have the annotations of the record citations for each of these, where adjustments to skid trails and landings were made at Mr. Johnson's request. I think we also have a footnote in our brief where I laid out these citations to the record. The first inspection report from December 1st, 2010, is at Appendix 932 on Appendix 9. All of these 10 inspection reports essentially deal with adjustments being made to skid trails and landings in response to requests from the purchaser.
Evidence. What kinds of adjustments to the skid trails?
Additional.
Lengthening? Extending them? Or
extending them.
Something else?
Permitting
else?
Additional trees to be cut around them with regard particularly to landings, enlarging them at their purchaser's request. Additionally, there's a note, and I think in appellant's opening brief, it did cite to an objection actually being noted on an inspection report, such that there is evidence that an objection could have been noted there. Therefore, the absence of objection there is even more probative of the fact that there was no relationship or contract interference here or problem with the way that the skid trails were approved. And that's at Appendix 1076. And as we point out in our brief, that notation of an objection there is actually an objection to the purchaser's own layout crew having laid out skid trails in a way that went through skips and old stump growths, such that they could not drag the logs there. Back to fundamentally, Your Honor, this case does come down to a failure of proof on the part of the appellant before this court to establish the facts that were alleged to have breached the contract. And that is, with regard to skid trails, the breaching facts being alleged that they were replete with trees in them. That is the allegation in the opening brief of the appellant before this court. That allegation is not substantiated in the record as the board found. Therefore, breach of contract with regard to skid trails fails. With regard to landings, equally, there is no record evidence of the operator being required to operate in what are called undersized landings. The contract doesn't...
Can I just clarify? I don't think landings are an issue in this case, right? Not on appeal. I think it was argued below, but I don't think that's an issue on appeal. Am I misunderstanding that?
Your Honor, the appellant has made an argument about landings. Granted, appellant's argument is not entirely clear, and I would be loath to try to summarize it necessarily accurately, but the argument as I understand it with regard to landings was that there was no contract language supporting the board's interpretation. The board's interpretation of the landings provision was that the contract gave the appellant discretion, because it made operational efficiency the benchmark for approving landings. Therefore, the board found that gave the purchaser discretion to determine the size of landings. Still, however, the board found at Appendix 3, based on Section B6.422, that the agency still had to agree with the appellant on where the location of those landings were going to be. So, contrary to the appellant's assertion, there is contract language for the board's determination that the appellant had discretion to decide the size of landings such that subject to the agency then approving their location. On the factual piece of the landings argument, the board found that the allegations, and appellant contend or challenges the board's finding that the allegations around landing size being undersized, because the contract actually allocated responsibility to the purchaser to decide the landing sizes, that allegations of being required to operate in an undersized landing was not evidence of breach, because that was the purchaser's responsibility under the contract. And even to the implied duty framing that the case has taken, there is no evidence in the record that the agency abused any discretion that it may have had in approving either the size or the location of landings under the contract, but rather there is a cooperative pattern of planning, approval, and construction of landings. And that cooperative pattern bears out, for example, that in the inspection reports at Appendix 932, Appendix 1027, Appendix 1041, and Appendix 1076. So again, to finalize the response to Judge Stoll's question, I do believe landings is at issue in the case. However, it might be slightly different than the skid trail issue. Just to touch briefly on that covers, I believe, the dearth of evidence presented by the appellant, which makes the breach claims fail for failure to establish the facts that are alleged to have breached the contract. The court, therefore, need not actually reach the contract interpretation issue, because failure to establish, as a matter of fact, the breaching facts, of course, negates the breach of contract claim. But under the contract, the agency was not required to permit the removal of all trees within skid trails. The tree prescription, as Judge Stoll pointed out, it does give ample indicia of it applying within the confines of approved skid trails at Appendix 739, that it does talk about all skid trails and landings having been identified and approved before the tree prescription is implemented, yes, there is a temporal limitation in that clause that this court's contract interpretation precedent must respect, would cause the court to need to respect. And by categorizing or conceptualizing either a skid trail or a landing as a constructed clearing under B2.32, that would render that temporal limitation meaningless. Because if it were the case, as appellant would have it, that all trees within skid trails and landings, regardless of whatever else was going on, must be cleared, then it doesn't matter when you apply the tree prescription vis-a-vis skid trails and landings. So that B2.32 argument ultimately is meritless for rendering the tree prescription meaningless, as the board found. There was no unilateral right, as the panel concluded with the appellant. There was no unilateral right.
Just to really follow up quickly on the tree prescription provision, you're saying that the government had the right under the contract to first define where the skid trails were going to be, and then second, had the right to require trees to not be cut down in the middle of those skid trails. I mean, is that a reasonable reading of the contract? That the government has the right to have a blockade of trees in the skid trail?
Your Honor, that contractual right exists under the contract. However, in this case, there has been no abuse of the government's right to do so. No abuse has been established by the appellant. And for the court's awareness as well, I should have pointed out at appendix, I believe it's Appendix 738 has the beginning of the tree prescription, the C provision, C2.35. The second sentence of that provision on Appendix 738 is that additional timber to be cut, if any, will be designated for cutting in accordance with Section B2.37. And that is the section that the contracting officer testified to before the board as the one that she relied upon to permit the purchaser to clear all trees within the confines of the approved skid trails. And that testimony is at Appendix 1823 and also at Appendix 1852. So ultimately, we're arguing in this case about something that was failed to be proven. We're arguing about circumstances, trees in skid trails or trees along skid trails that cause skid trails to be inefficiently zigzagging throughout the forest when there actually is no proof, as a matter of fact, that that's what happened, but rather there is substantial countervailing evidence that the board weighed, and this court, of course, does not reweigh the evidence on appeal to conclude conclusively that there was no evidence of contract interference when it came to approval of skid trails and landings. And for that reason, and those in our briefs, we respectfully request that this court affirm the decision of the board. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd first like to just reiterate that what is clear, that was proven, that the board accepted, was that the skid trails were adjusted to move around reserve trees. And under the contract, that's not supposed to happen. The skid trails come first, then the reserve trees get designated after, not the other way around. As to landings, the purchaser does not have unfettered discretion under the contract to decide the size of the landings, and so we take issue with the board's conclusion that Johnson did. It's not true. And we can just look at some of the inspection reports that counsel highlighted where Johnson had to specifically ask, can I cut a few more of these trees to expand my landing? The fact that he had to ask shows us that he's not in control of the size of the landings. As a practical matter, the department was in charge of that. And the contract says that the department has to approve. And so they used that approval authority to impose the landings that they wanted. And my time is up, so I'll just again ask the court to reverse and remand back to the board.
Thank you. We thank both sides, and the case is submitted.
Thank you.